Hot Air is a co-production of American University Washington College of Law and the American Bar Association. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Goldstein, and along with Lauren Trevisan, I'd like to welcome you today to SDLP's symposium. We are excited about the speakers today and the topics. The symposium focuses on the complex and multifaceted conflicts surrounding the use and development of various natural resources. The speakers today will give their perspectives from the private, nonprofit, and government sectors. They'll discuss how the use of legal and policy mechanisms can be used to mitigate and prevent natural resource impacts. The first panel will examine challenges and opportunities in the development of alternative energy resources, including a brief discussion of the problems with fossil fuels. The second panel will address the development of public lands and natural resources, including land use and issues we face domestically. We hope these panels not only address the problems that face the world, but offer solutions and food for thought. Lastly, Carl Brusch from the Environmental Law Institute will present on international resource conflicts, particularly how natural resources fuel many armed conflicts around the world. Thank you for attending today, and we hope you enjoy the symposium. I'm now going to hand it over to Professor Leiter, who will start with the first panel. Thanks.
So thank you very much for being here. We're excited to have these great speakers with us. Thank you all for coming. This panel is on alternative energy approaches. My one slight substantive contribution or example is that I've just gone solar in my house. I'm very excited. I've put solar panels on the roof, and I now can monitor the about 40% of the house power that comes from the solar panels. So I get to log in every day, and I get a screen that shows me how much power I'm getting day by day, and obviously goes up and down with cloud cover, et cetera. So it's a lot of fun to actually be seeing some of the pros and some of the difficulties of the new technology. So we will be hearing first from Kate Colarulli from the Sierra Club Beyond Oil Campaign. And she will discuss the problems with fossil fuel, sort of setting the stage for us as to why we're looking at these alternative technologies. Then Ann Mesnikoff, who is the Green Transportation Director for Sierra Club, will give us a sense of what the opportunities are for alternative energies, sort of an introduction to the various alternative energy approaches. Then we'll turn to Jim McElfish, who's a Senior Attorney and Director of the Sustainable Use of Land Program at the Environmental Law Institute, and he will talk about energy development policies, taxes, and investments, so policy approaches to encourage development of alternative energy. Then we will hear from Michelle Boyd, who's the Government Relations Manager for Abengoa, I'm not sure I'm pronouncing that right, Abengoa Solar, who will teach us about concentrating solar power, or CSP technology, why it's important and what is needed and financially, et cetera, policies in order to develop CSP technology. And then finally from Chris Berendt, who is of counsel at Drinker Biddle and head of their environmental markets team on environmental and energy markets, including project development and investment. And since we're getting a little bit of a late start, if I can ask each of the panelists to stay right in the
12 to 15 minute range. Thanks. Good morning. I'm Kate Colarulli. And let's see here. I'm going to pull up a PowerPoint for you all. I'm the Associate Campaign Director for the Sierra Club. And I'm here to talk just a little bit to set the stage, make sure we're all on the same place around as we look and think about fossil fuels. Does anyone know how to pull up this PowerPoint? Oh, it's this guy right here, isn't it? All right. Okay, excellent. So thank you so much for having me. To kind of just jump right into it, so I can figure out how to work this thing. There we go. Okay, we're going to just do this the nice, slow way, right like that. Okay, so just to start off, I think it's always good to take a look at why we're in this game, why we care about sustainable energy. And the simple way to say it is that right now our use of fossil fuels is driving us to really unacceptable consequences. Global warming is quickly getting out of control, and the time that we have to fix this problem is dwindling. So one of the big thing that we work on at the Sierra Club in my campaign is oil, which is about 42% of our carbon emissions in the states, with coal and natural gas being right behind it. And there's a lot of reasons, besides just the climate change and global warming implications, of why we're concerned about our use of oil. We spend between $60 and $80 billion a year in this country dealing with health impacts that have been caused from burning oil, primarily in our cars, respiratory illnesses, asthma. Asthma alone is $14 billion in healthcare costs. The BP disaster was a great recent example of the environmental problems that we have in this country. But just to kind of put it in perspective, just in the state of Louisiana, we're seeing around 4,000 oil spills a year. And it's just that the really big ones are the ones that come to our attention. And, of course, we've got all the problems with air pollution that aren't carbon-related. They're talking about the toxic criteria pollutants that are coming out. Oil is also, and we see this around fossil fuels, but oil is the biggest one, also has huge implications on our economic health in this country. This is a study done by a Bloomberg economist, and the gray lines are U.S. recessions. The red is oil purchase as a percentage of our GDP. And what we see is before every single major U.S. recession, there is a spike in oil prices. And so there is a growing theory. I did my graduate degree is an MBA, but a growing theory of study in business schools where you look at the way oil prices are impacting the U.S. economy. And the other thing that we're seeing a lot these days is the amount of money coming from these big fossil fuel companies into our politics. The Keystone XL pipeline is a big tar sands pipeline. I'm going to do a little case study on that in a couple minutes. But we recently had a big vote on that in Congress, and we saw that the senators that voted for Keystone XL have received 500% more from the oil industry than those that voted against. And so we're seeing this unfortunate influx and push of financial contributions and how that's affecting the votes in this country. And really, I think that there's no better example of that than the past year, the attacks we've seen on the Environmental Protection Agency. And if you look at the money that's driving those attacks, it's pretty scary. So I was asked to do just a quick case study on a dirty fuel and a fight that the environmental community has launched around fossil fuels to lead into, as you guys talk about, the rest of the panel is going to be talking about the alternative solutions and the clean solutions that are being put forward. So I thought I would do one on tar sands because it's been kind of the environmental sexy topic in the last year. And one of the interesting things to note about our use of fossil fuels is that our use of fossil fuels is changing, and we're using more and more high carbon fuels as peak oil, as our easy to reach oil supplies dwindle, as global demand grows with India and China coming online, we're seeing these types of fuels, which are much more carbon intensive, much more environmentally damaging, growing in their use. This is a EIA outlook of how much we're going to be using by 2030. So tar sands are one of those examples of these very unsustainable fuels. They're found under the Canadian Boreal Forest, which is the largest intact remaining ecological system in the world. And it stores about 11% of the world's carbon. So it's a really critical carbon storage. In addition to being this gorgeous remaining wilderness. And tar sands are found underneath it. And what the industry is doing, this is one of the largest industrial projects currently happening in the world, it's happening up in Canada, is they are strip mining the forest and digging down to reach this dirt. And this dirt has this hydrocarbon called bitumen in it that can be turned into conventional oil through a series of refining and processes. And it has all of these intense environmental consequences. It has 20% over its life cycle more carbon. It uses vast amounts of water. The tar sands industrial complex alone is using enough natural gas to heat Canadian homes. And they're creating these huge toxic waste zones. They also have huge consequences on birds and on wildlife. 30% of American songbirds nest in this area, and we're seeing every year about 200,000 birds are dying due to this development. And they have huge people impacts as well. I just skipped through a First Nations slide. And why this is interesting for someone that's taking a U.S. law course is that the U.S. is the intended market for this fossil fuel. We use about a fourth of the world's oil, and we have a huge impact on how these fossil fuels are developed, the investment that flows into them, and how they're used and regulated. So recently, there's been a number of tar sands pipelines that are being proposed to come down into the United States. And specifically, the industry is trying to reach international shipping ports in the United States so that they can not only reach throughout the U.S. market, but that they can also reach down to Latin America, Europe, Asia, et cetera. And the environmental community has mounted a major coalition and fight to stop these pipelines as a way of trying to control the development that's happening in the tar sands. And we have a four-step strategy for how we're trying to do that, but the first place that we start is by looking at U.S. laws and U.S. regulations. Just to kind of quickly go through this, essentially what we're trying to do is we're limiting the market, and by limiting the market, we're able to control the investment dollars that are going into this fuel and control the amount of destruction that is happening and the amount of carbon that is resulting. And the first way we do that is we go about looking for our legal hooks. The U.S. has some of the best environmental laws in the world, and they give us an ability to look at different ways that we can create the right processes so that these decisions aren't just rubber stamped, but actually get proper public input and are made in a way that takes into consideration all the consequences, whether they're wildlife consequences or they're consequences that have to do with global warming. By using our legal strategy, we're able to open up the timeline and open up the process. So the decision-making takes into account a lot of different types of viewpoints. So it may be people that live along the route of the pipeline. It may be people that live in the refining communities. And it may just be people that, such as myself, have, you know, believe that increasing the carbon in our air is going to have an impact on my children's future. And so I want to have a say in it. And so by opening up the market, by limiting and using our legal tactics, we're able to get to number two, which is limiting the market for high carbon oil through public opposition. So we're able to spend the time to educate the public and get them to put pressure on decision makers. The other thing that we're able to do with our legal arm is we're able to look at the regulations that affect these pipelines. So with the tar sands, for example, one thing that we've done is we've created this stringent environmental review process under NEPA. That kind of gets to one and two. The second thing we've done is we're going in and we're looking at the government agencies that regulate pipelines, and we're trying to create specific regulations that have to do with tar sands, because right now there are none on the books. And so we're working with PHMSA, which is the Pipeline and Hazardous Safety Materials Agency under DOT, to do that. And ultimately, our goal is to put in place these laws and regulations that are going to move the U.S. away from high carbon fuels and move it towards the better, more sustainable alternatives. So I created a bunch of PowerPoint slides, and I don't want to take too much time with this because I want to turn it over. I've got about five more minutes in my allotted time, but I thought you guys might be interested in looking through these later, so these slides are available for you if you want. But to go back to our tar sands case study, we've recently been fighting a pipeline called the Keystone XL pipeline, which is one of the largest pipelines, would be one of the largest pipelines in the U.S., and it's essentially what's called a bullet pipeline, which would move tar sands through six states over 2,000 miles down to the Houston refineries. And that has all been under the auspices of the Department of State. And so we have worked, and it's primarily initially for the first several years been a legal battle where we've worked with the Department of State to put in place the proper procedures under NEPA, and then move through those procedures in a way that we were able to build opposition to defeat the pipeline. So what I did is I just kind of mapped out the timeline of this fight so that you guys could see the different places in which our legal strategy was instrumental in coming into play. One of the interesting things that I've learned from working in the environmental community is that many, many times federal agencies and state agencies do not go through the proper procedures. And unless there is some type of outside third party, such as the Sierra Club, saying, wait a second, we actually have laws around this, you have to do X or you have to do Y, it just doesn't happen. And so what we had to do is we had to actually go in and have a series of meetings with the Department of State's legal counsel to convince them that they were going to be putting in place a full NEPA review, despite the lobbying there. We had to work with the White House, we had to work with the EPA and DOT and all these other involved agencies to force that process to be implemented. Then the process was implemented and it just wasn't done well, because the Department of State didn't have any expertise in this type of environmental law and environmental review. And so they kind of put out a crappy environmental impact statement. And we had to go back, lobby the EPA, lobby the DOT, lobby Department of Energy, and able to get them to do the next step, which is when, if EPA rated it as being inadequate, we could get a supplemental. And so again, we used our legal team to come back in and restart the process so it was done adequately. And what this timeline really shows is that by using NEPA, the pipeline fight went from being something that was expected to be done in 9 months to be something that's taken 3 years, which, depending on where you stand on whether you want this pipeline permitted, is either a good thing or a bad thing. But from our perspective, what it allowed us to do is go out and educate these different agencies and the public about what tar sands were, because nobody really knew. It allowed us to go out to the Pipeline Hazardous and Safety Administration and bring them in and talk to them about what this is and start a process through Congress wherein Congress has mandated that we need a study putting together tar sands pipeline regulations. So it gave us a lot of open space for different strategies to happen. And over the course of it, we're not yet done with this pipeline fight, but we've made some major progress, and it's possible that we will have killed this pipeline this year. And what I did on this slide is just kind of sum up what that did. A lot of times we win environmental fights, not only by bringing in the public and creating a court of public opinion where we win, but we also do it by shifting the burden of cost away from the public and back to the responsible company or firm. And in this case, it's one of the key things that we've done. The delay has cost that company a couple billion dollars. So just to kind of sum up, when the Sierra Club looks at our campaigns, the campaigns we run, one of the first things that happens in terms of our important theory of change is always looking at the legal opportunities that we have. So our environmental law program will come in, we'll identify what hooks we have under our different environmental laws in this country. We often have to have very serious conversations with the involved federal and state agencies to make those a reality. And then we're able to move to the next step in the fight, which bring in the public, put the pressure on whichever our target is, and move to creating the appropriate incentives to move away from fossil fuels and towards more sustainable alternatives. And I'm happy to take questions on any of this afterwards. Okay, I can click this.
Good morning, everybody. So I'm Ann Mesnikoff, and I run Sierra Club's Green Transportation Campaign. And, you know, when I was looking at the subject matter for today, challenges and opportunities in alternative energy development, I had to put that into my green transportation context. So you'll have to bear with me as I sort of talk through some of the issues that we work on, some of the process and the laws that we've used to help deal with transportation oil consumption, as Kate noted. You know, oil is a tremendous issue for us. In our transportation system, we use about two-thirds of the oil consumed every day in the United States. So about 13 million barrels a day go into our transportation system. About 8.5 million of those go into cars and light trucks that we drive every day, and we drive about 3 trillion miles a year. So we have a lot of need, a lot of demand, and there's alternative fuels coming into play. But for those to have a meaningful role in our transportation system, we need to, A, reduce the amount of fuel our vehicles are using, B, reduce how much we're driving, and then hopefully create some space for hopefully sustainable fuels to displace oil somewhat. Hold on, I'm going to go grab my water bottle. So I think everybody is noticing that gas prices are rising. It's in the news. It's in the political discourse. We're seeing, the drill, baby, drill mantra come back in the presidential and the Republican presidential campaign. And, one candidate, Newt Gingrich, has promised that we're going to have 250-gallon gas if he's elected. So that's a hard promise to keep, I'll tell you that. But let me jump to how I chose to put transportation and oil consumption into the context of the subject matter for today, which, again, is how do we reduce demand for oil, how do we reduce how much we're driving, and then what alternative fuels will come in to displace oil. And there's some good news, which is that what we call fuel economy standards and now greenhouse gas standards for vehicles are on the rise. And that is no small feat. It is a tremendous impact on global warming emissions. It will have a tremendous impact on how much oil we're consuming. It will have a tremendous impact on how much money we're spending on oil at the gas pump. Under this, the first term of the Obama administration, we will have seen standards for new vehicles in place to double the fuel economy of new vehicles sold between 2012 and 2025. One of the things the president did when he came into office in 2008 was to begin this process so that we have standards in place for 2012 to 2016 cars. Last November, he proposed standards for 2017 to 2025 vehicles. That rule will be final in the summer. And the impact of these rules is that by 2030, and we have to look out in the future, these standards will reduce oil consumption by about 3.3 million barrels a day, keep $125 billion in our economy that year, and reduce greenhouse gas emissions by about 600 million metric tons. And I'm going to give a little bit of backstory because, this administration has essentially ended what was about 30 years of stagnation when it came to fuel economy standards. And it was really sort of an interesting story that got us to this point. The original fuel economy laws were set in 1975. We had an oil embargo. The average car sold in the United States averaged about 13 miles per gallon, and there was a need to do something about that. So we ended up with what's called CAFE standards, or fuel economy standards, and between 1975 and late 1980s, that ended up being 1989, the average fuel economy of new vehicles sold doubled from 13 to 27.5 miles per gallon. That was for cars. Light trucks was a loophole in the original CAFE law. We're sort of left up to the Department of Transportation, to an agency called NHTSA, to set standards for light trucks, and not much happened. And I think most of us will sort of recognize that there is the burgeoning of the sport utility vehicle market, the light truck market, gas guzzling vehicles. Gasoline was cheap, and vehicles that were about 20% of the new vehicle market in the 1970s became more than half the vehicle market, and we ended up with significant increases in our oil consumption. And we had a little bit of a problem, which was that once the fuel economy standards were phased in by 1989, there was sort of a lack of interest in doing more. Sierra Club led an effort with two senators, Senator Gorton from Washington, a Republican, and Senator Bryan from Nevada, to try to pass a new law to follow up on that original law to raise CAFE standards to 40 miles per gallon. That law failed in 1990 by 3 votes in the Senate. And there were several reasons why that law failed and why we ended up with essentially 3 decades of stagnation in fuel economy. One was a very powerful auto industry that said that any changes to fuel economy standards were going to be bad for them, were going to result in unsafe vehicles, that they couldn't put technology to work. They had an entrenched and powerful congressional delegation that blocked any effort to raise standards, and they were joined by the United Auto Workers, by labor. So you had a convergence that essentially put pressure on the agency that was charged with raising those standards to do nothing. And so we had a very long period of inaction. When President Clinton came into office, I think the auto industry got a little nervous. Maybe they raised standards. So they actually took an interesting effort of attaching a rider, a provision to the annual appropriations for the Department of Transportation that said essentially, thou shalt not think about fuel economy standards. I mean, literally, the agency could not study it, could not talk about it, could not think about it throughout the Clinton administration. Every year that rider went into place, every year we would fight that rider, try to at least convince Congress that the agency should study the issue. And that thaw in CAFE freeze didn't end until, I think it was about 1999, when in the 2000 appropriations, the National Academy of Sciences was allowed to study the opportunities to raise fuel economy, safety, the technologies, et cetera, and it took a couple of years for that report to come out and say, in fact, technologies exist, we can safely make fuels go further on a gallon of gas. And so I want to kind of jump into a different point because I think there was a lot of frustration. You couldn't get anything done in Congress. You couldn't get anything done through the agencies. So Sierra Club and other groups, those in California, Blue Water Network, among others, came up with a strategy to kind of do an end run around national policy. You can't raise fuel economy standards nationally. What are the other opportunities? And one of the opportunities was to go to California, which under the Clean Air Act has the authority to set its own standards for vehicle tailpipes. That had historically been applied to smog pollutants and other pollutants that come out of a tailpipe. But the strategy was developed to regulate greenhouse gases coming out of the tailpipe of vehicles. Every gallon of gas burned emits about 19 pounds of carbon dioxide out of the tailpipe. You can add some on for upstream emissions. So there was a rationale there for using the Clean Air Act, using California's authority to set standards for cars. That was a legislative effort in California that was led by a California legislator named Fran Pavley, and that law became the Pavley Law and the Pavley Standards that ensued under the California Air Resources Board. So we sort of had inaction at the federal level. We went around that, had a state set standards for greenhouse gas emissions coming out of vehicle tailpipes. 13 other states were allowed to adopt those standards between 2002 and 2007. By 2007, 40% of the new vehicle market was now under a California standard. Couldn't implement those standards because they needed a waiver from EPA, and the Bush administration was not moving quickly with that waiver. But nonetheless, the auto industry was sort of seeing change on the horizon. They either were going to end up having to comply with a state standard in 13 states in California or figure out what they needed to do nationally to get something done. There were several court cases in which the auto industry challenged the ability of California to use the Clean Air Act, including one that went to the Supreme Court, Mass versus EPA, in which the Supreme Court did in fact recognize that the Clean Air Act could cover carbon dioxide emissions. It was a pollutant under the Clean Air Act if EPA found it as such, and that when it came to setting vehicle standards, the Department of Transportation and EPA could figure that out and work together. And in fact, they have. So that sort of resulted in an interesting dynamic in which finally by 2007, the auto industry felt the need for change. Congress saw that things were going to change, and we ended up with an energy bill that, in fact, directed the Department of Transportation to raise national fuel economy standards to 35.5 miles per gallon by 2020. In comes the Obama administration. One of the first things the Obama administration did was say, we're going to give California the waiver it needs to implement its standards. We're also then going to direct EPA, Department of Transportation, to work with California to set national greenhouse gas standards, new fuel economy standards. That gave us the 2012 to 2016 standards. And within a few weeks of finalizing those standards, we now have new national standards through 2025. I've worked on this issue for a really long time. It's amazing to see that much progress being made in a few short years. It will make a difference in the vehicles. If you all choose to buy vehicles, I'll get to transportation policy very quickly after this. But I think we'll see tremendous change in the new vehicle market, including a lot of electric vehicles coming into play. Let me just jump very quickly to transportation policy. That's also been in the news lately. We have a deadline of March 31st for Congress to decide if we get a new national transportation policy or they bicker over extending the 2005 transportation bill that has a acronym of Safety Lou, and the Lou part of that has a little bit of history. One is that it was Don Young's wife, and he had always promised her he would name a bill after her, so you get the Lou part, but it was also Legacy for Users, and it's really an apt name for a transportation bill that did very little to change how we're using oil in the transportation sector. That bill has been extended for 2.5 years now. And just last week, the Senate passed a new transportation bill called MAP 21. It's a 2-year bill, $109 billion bill for 2 years of transportation spending. It's not a perfect bill. We welcome that as taking some steps forward. For the first time, it would put national objectives into transportation policy. Reducing oil consumption or energy use is one of those objectives. Has a few other changes in place that we felt were progress over the existing safety loop program. The House, on the other hand, has been struggling. Speaker Boehner took over the transportation policy in the House, put forward what was called the worst transportation bill ever, which essentially tied transit funding to a big oil wish list, a drill baby drill agenda, drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, drilling off of every coast everywhere, among other things. And taking transit funding out of the Highway Trust Fund, where it's been for 30 years, eviscerating spending on bicycle and pedestrian programs, and actually gutting NEPA in order to facilitate more highways. So we now have 8 legislative days left. We have a Senate bill, which is a good step forward. We have the House trying to figure out if he can even move something. Even in the current dynamics, I don't know exactly what will happen. They have to act by March 31st. The gas tax is now just by timing tied in with transportation policy. So I think it's something worth following, but I think there is an opportunity to get a bill in place that follows on what the vehicle standards do. Those will improve the vehicles we drive, but we need a transportation policy that will reduce how much we drive, investing in transportation choices, better and more transit and access to transit, better biking and walking. I mean, making those things safer do increase the amount of opportunities people have to bike and walk for transportation. These are all things that are in play with these bills, and I think it's necessary ultimately to have the right national policy in place because that will drive how states and localities make their transportation plans and decide how to spend their dollars. Let me say, I know I have a few minutes left. Let me get to alternative fuels. The 2007 energy bill that I mentioned also included a renewable fuel standard. In the case of renewable fuels, this generally means ethanol, has historically meant ethanol as a transportation fuel to displace oil. The renewable fuel standard was in the law. EPA was then directed to set up a program for the renewable fuel standard. The legislation directed that by 2022, 36 billion gallons of alternative fuels would be put into the transportation mix. We use about 121 billion gallons of gasoline each year in this country, so 36 billion gallons could be significant by 2022, but we're having a hard time getting there. Unfortunately, what the original law did was lock in about 12 to 13 billion gallons of corn ethanol, which is a whole other conversation, but sets up this constant tension between food and fuel. Corn ethanol has a questionable greenhouse gas profile. There's a lot of energy that has to go into growing the corn, to turning it into the fuel. There are opportunities to fix some of that, but I think we're seeing some huge challenges to coming up with what would be second-generation fuels that could add on to the corn ethanol that's already into the mix, fuels from algae, fuels from potentially from garbage, fuels from cellulosic plant matter and other wastes or crops that are not food crops that need to be grown in the right places. There's a lot of issues that are involved in getting the right mix of alternative fuels into our transportation system. There's certainly a lot of interest in natural gas as a fuel, but that has huge consequences, and we need to deal with how we're extracting that natural gas. That's a different issue, but the fracking that is going on right now in terms of pulling natural gas out of different places in the country is a huge issue. We need to consider all of these factors before we jump in and locking ourselves into a different fuel mix for our transportation system. Let me briefly touch on electric vehicles, because I think there's a huge opportunity to electrify our transportation system. I know that some will say that switching from oil to coal is a terrible choice to make for our transportation system, but the one thing we can say about electric vehicles is that we can clean up the grid. We have a very robust campaign at Sierra Club to move coal out and bring in a clean energy system. Getting electric vehicles fueled off of the sun, off of the wind, off of other renewable energies is a real opportunity we see. It won't happen tomorrow, but we're seeing manufacturers come out with more and more electric vehicles. I think electric vehicles matched with a system in which we're driving less, in which our communities are more convenient, we have better access to public transportation, I think we could see some real change going forward. So I think that there's a sense of optimism, at least on transportation. I think the vehicle standards, we've always called those the biggest single step because it is one policy that changes everything that the manufacturers make. It changes the marketplace. It is a one policy lever to win. Transportation is a much more complicated beast in terms of reducing how much we drive. Those are decisions that are intrinsically local, although driven by federal policy. So hopefully we'll see a good policy emerge either by the end of this month, shortly thereafter. I don't have a crystal ball, so I won't make any bets on that. And it may get kicked after the election because it is a contentious issue. So I'll leave it at that. I think we see some real change. I think it will make a huge difference in greenhouse gas emissions. It will make a big difference in our future of oil addiction. And I think we do see some policy changes and opportunities coming forward. But certainly no easy solutions when it comes to alternative fuels. But you know, there is a lot of effort going into to bringing better fuels into the mix. And again, as if we reduce how much we're using, there's better opportunity for those alternative fuels to have a meaningful impact on our oil consumption. Thanks.
I'm Jim McElfish with the Environmental Law Institute. And this is a good segue from Ann's presentation, because I'm going to focus on one aspect of electric power generation, and that is the potential of commercial wind energy. I'm going to focus primarily on commercial-scale wind as opposed to household or community wind. So what I'm talking about is those 200-foot or 300-foot tall wind turbines that many of you have either seen on the ridges of western Pennsylvania or in the commercials during the last presidential campaign when both candidates in the general election ran vistas of wind energy as sort of a promise of modern technology and where things might go. I'm hopeful we'll see that again, but I have some concerns that we might not this time around. It's important to note that wind offers a real upside potential for modernizing our technology, for revitalizing our manufacturing base in the U.S. because it's cheaper to manufacture and transport these large wind turbine setups and facilities domestically than to import them from somewhere else. And it's an area where the United States still has a substantial amount of leadership. In fact, up until last year, the United States led the world in the amount of installed wind capacity. So people would talk about Europe where they're countries with a larger percentage. But in terms of the actual amount of nameplate megawatt generating wind capacity, the U.S. Led all other nations until last year when it was surpassed by China, which is investing in all forms of energy. One of the other things that I think is important is that the conversation that one can have about these alternative energies can be put in terms of diversification of the energy supply, so that it doesn't have to be about clean energy or greenhouse gases or climate change or those sort of things, but simply diversifying the portfolio, enabling us to rely on a broad variety of forms of energy and thereby cushioning shocks in oil markets or natural gas or whether tar sands gets here or what may happen. And I think that can be of interest or value in having a sustainability conversation with people. We have, as of the end of this year, 46 gigawatts or 46,000 megawatts of wind installed in operation in the United States. It's a huge increase over just 10 years ago. It amounts to about 2% of electric power generation in the U.S. And the Department of Energy put forward an ambitious scenario of reaching 20% wind by 2030. It's doable with existing technology. Whether or not the investments will be made is still up for grabs. But if you remember the initial graph, which I think included more than electric power, that Kate had up there. Having a fairly large percentage of that supplied by wind, or as my co-panelists will talk about later, solar energy, provides us with a pretty interesting pie chart and diversification. So one of the things that is greatly affecting wind in the near term is the production tax credit, the tax credit that Congress created and renews off and on, and it expires, and then you have to go back, and it has made financing wind projects extremely difficult. The tax credit expires at the end of this year, and from all accounts, the wind energy industry will essentially fall off a cliff or go into hibernation for a period of time if the production tax credit is not timely renewed. It's not that it will go away, but many of the projects that were slated or planned in the pipeline are not likely to occur because of the financing issue. And there's some argument, should we be investing or having tax credits for various forms of energy? My institute, Environmental Law Institute, did a study 2 years ago where we looked at all forms of subsidy, tax subsidy and other, for all forms of energy. And if you go to our website at eli.org, you'll be able to find a pie chart which has the numbers annotating it. And in fact, we subsidize all forms of energy in this country, and the renewables less than any other. So there's some argument about at what point in industry's development you can or should, as a matter of public policy, engage in those kind of subsidies. I'm going to spend the rest of my time focusing on one issue that we've looked at pretty deeply, and that is the issue of siting of wind energy facilities. As you might imagine, these facilities are fairly large in comparison with others when you look at just the generating facility. The National Renewable Energy Laboratory did a study a year ago looking at all the installed wind projects, and they found that the median area of land occupied by wind energy projects was an area of about 4 square miles. That's not the footprint of each turbine or the access roads, but kind of spread across the landscape, you're talking about a 4 square mile area, which is a very large area when you also consider the fact that in 48 of our 50 states, local governments have a substantial amount, or at least some say, in how these things are sited. This is not a role that local governments are accustomed to. Local governments in most states have no role whatsoever in mine site siting or regulation, or in where oil and gas can be drilled. Many of them don't have that role even on large coal-fired power plants, or if they do, it relates to siting them in an industrial zone rather than some other sort of zone. Wind energy is a little different because of the way it tends to occupy areas that also have other uses for farms or residences or industrial or commercial areas. In about two-thirds of the states, the local governments are the primary regulators of wind siting. And this poses a great challenge because most of them don't have the expertise to deal with these things. And initially, the wind that's already been sited has been sited in a lot of the easy places, where local governments are not strong or welcome. There's a lot of wind facilities in West Texas and North Dakota where land use regulation is not a historic tradition, or it's not hard to get zoning approvals. But as these become more ubiquitous, we're going to see more and more the issue of how do local governments decide, or do states need to step in. A number of states have state siting boards that can trump or overrule local siting where necessary. Washington is a state that has a lot of wind facilities sited, and they have an energy facility siting council, which It used to be largely devoted to large-scale, hydroelectric and fossil fuel, but the law was amended to cover wind of any size, recognizing that there were these potential conflicts. And that board has engaged in siting choices. New York State is a state where wind siting is almost all local, and since New York is not mostly a county government but is a town and village government state, you can imagine all the sort of fights that arise where the scenic vista is now gone, or the will this be compatible with my dairy farming operation, or how will this go? And there's this opportunity for lots of give and take before local elected boards, almost none of which are full-time but have day jobs and then go to the village board meeting or the town board meeting in the evenings and hear the reports and try to make decisions. And so there's been a lot of back and forth on will these be cited. Last August, the General Assembly in New York, which agrees on almost nothing, did pass a law which now assigns siting of wind facilities over 25 megawatts to a state siting council. For each decision, that council will add two local members, so there will be a local component, but the idea was this sort of local option siting was just making reaching the renewable standards just too hard to do in New York. Another example is Wisconsin. Wisconsin had pretty hospitable laws towards wind and solar in the 1970s, was one of the leaders, but the laws hadn't kept up with commercial scale wind. The idea was much more the little windmill in the yard or the rooftop solar. When the larger scale wind began to come in, there were some court cases, and the courts basically said that local governments couldn't pass ordinances setting standards. They had to decide each case on an individual case-by-case basis, and it threw things into turmoil on, well, can you cite commercial-scale wind in Wisconsin or not? So the legislature put together a study commission, spent 2 years studying it, and went to the public utility regulator. The public utility regulator adopted final rules. The rules came in. And then we had the complete turnover in the Wisconsin legislature and the governorship, which achieved a lot of notoriety for rancor on unionizing public officials and who's going to be recalled or not. But a byproduct of this was enough mistrust of state level government at all levels that on the last possible day for the state legislature to disapprove the state public utility regulation, which had been the result of this public bipartisan process, the legislature vetoed the rule. So now there is no rule governing siting in Wisconsin, either pro or con. The requirement is that it meets state standards but be administered locally, but there are no state standards and the locals have nothing to administer. So the commercial wind projects that were slated to go forward in Wisconsin pulled the plug after that's happened and we're in a sort of limbo kind of state. I mention these not to kind of emphasize Wisconsin is not the way to go. They actually have a pretty good set of rules from the comparisons that we have. Or to advocate, I'm not trying to advocate that it needs to be a state-level siting that takes no local issues into account, but that there's this sort of trade-off or byproduct of our mixed system of land use and power regulation, which is not well adapted to a diverse commercial-scale generation where the wind turbines are sited on dozens of individual separate properties and yet are operating just like a 200 megawatt coal-fired power plant that presumably is sited in one area and then we have these other externalities where the coal mines are two states away and the railroad trains are coming in and those aren't regulated locally at all. So if you're interested in this set of issues, I'll give a little promotional thing for if you go to ELI.org, you can look at this publication, which looks at state enabling legislation and the local government role. A new publication just out by the American Planning Association, you know, the 20,000 planners around the country are having to deal with these as they're being asked by their county governments or their local governments. So planning for wind energy, this one they sell. I think there's some way to get a free download, but you have to go through some machinations, and so you're better off buying this one. This one's free. They cover different sorts of things. But these issues reveal that there are hurdles to get over if we're going to get to 20% wind by 2030, but I think we need to do it.
We'll hear from Chris next, and I apologize, I have to go to
Hi, everybody. I know that Jim talked about Wisconsin. He's got nothing against Cheddar. He's a lover of Wisconsin.
That's true.
We've had some good presentations that have built on the background of where our energy system is, and I think maybe I can try to lighten the mood a little bit and project forward where we're seeing things head. I help lead the energy and sustainability practice at Drinker, Biddle, and Reith. If you don't know us, we're one of the oldest law firms in the country, founded in 1849, and are a national law firm with offices across the country. I'll start off by saying that in discussing wind, it's apt because the new build environment for utility scale generation is quite stagnant right now. And there's a big reason for that. That's because our load has remained generally flat nationally and has not been growing significantly after this last recession. Most recessions end with a bump in load. This one isn't, and for a number of reasons beyond the economy, some I'll get into in a second here, but the reality is that renewable portfolio standards are really causing a drive and build out for large utility-scale renewables. Beyond that, with load being flat, other than new gas generation strategically built in places that would decongest certain high-priced markets, you're not really finding that much need for new generation to come online. New nuclear is only being built in the places in the country where cost recovery is guaranteed, where you have a utility that remains in a vertically integrated state, has not unbundled its resources, and is able to establish much of its own rates and cost recovery. You are not seeing new merchant nuclear generators. They tried that one with Calvert Cliffs, and the market laughed at them. The same thing with a lack of a carbon price signal, clean coal systems. You've seen what's happened to a lot of the flagship projects that we're going to do carbon capture and sequestration on site. They have had all their funding pull out because you haven't had enough of a price signal in the market to make that level of investment. The bottom line is that we're at this point now where, unlike in the past, beyond what's being driven by RPSs, you do not have a lot of new large generation being added here in the United States. Wind, because of the production tax credit, has its development cycle froze out about 6 months back. Part of the sad thing was, even if we were successful and saw something like Debbie Stabenow's amendment attached to the transportation bill, that would have just put the PTC in place to 2013. That would have really done nothing for the wind industry. It only meant a few projects that were frozen just at the right point in time in the development pipe would have been able to get built. And it's an example of how, without a level playing field in the incentive environment, an ELI study looking back historically is one of the best. It's very hard to make these instances. On the tax credit front, renewables have suffered from a renewable presence in the tax code. It's been disappointing. Extractive activities in the traditional energy sector benefit from the basic way the tax code is set up to be able to take advantage of high operating expenses. You compare that to the capital profile of renewables, where it's high technology, the fuel tends to be generally free, if we're talking about the power sector, and you are in a position where all the upfront capital is loaded in the cost of putting the technology in the ground. It's all upfront in CapEx. So there's quite a different pattern. Now, One of the reasons we're not seeing load grow, one of the reasons we're not seeing this big development boom is because we're experiencing really what I would describe as a tectonic shift in the way the power sector operates. And that is the rise of the demand side, not just as a cost point, but the rise of the demand side as a resource. Community scale resources, generators that are coming in at municipalities, schools, hospitals, and so on, that are anywhere from 4 to 10 megawatts, 15 megawatts in size, give or take. These are the types of projects that are booming the development pipe now as we speak and are likely going to be doing that for the next several years. This is really a huge shift because traditionally in the utility sector, even under competition, where you would tell a utility to take your generating assets and I want you to move those and they will go in a separate company, then the core utility assets, the one used to maintain the distribution lines, the wires, the linemen, and so on, it's called unbundling. Even under that competitive standpoint, say where we stand right now in interconnection called PJM and so on, you would still have utilities having a lot of control over demand side in programs called demand side management. What's really shifting is that through shifts in regulation and policy technology that have brought things such as demand response, on-site generation, and so on, we're beginning to see competition get at what used to be the last vestiges of the monopoly, the vertical integrated monopoly jurisdiction of utilities. And that is driving a lot of them to very aggressively get into these businesses. It's driving what I see as consolidation in the retail power sector, in the energy management power sector, in the energy service company, the ESCOs, and so on. And this is where a lot of the activity is going to be, and there's a lot of good reasons for it. I'm sure you're all aware of all the benefits of local on-site clean energy. I'm not going to have to get into that. One of the things that we're trying to do, and this is a distinction between this type of development area and the development area that Michelle is going to talk about, which is more boutique, public-private partnership focused. The types of developments that I'm talking about are ones where they're often project financed. And because you have tax-exempt entities involved, it requires complex deal structures to be put in place because you don't have the host university or the hospital and so on. The folks who want to take use of the benefits of the clean energy having a tax appetite to be able to use it. And the tax equity environment is not ideal. This is why we saw such a big boom when we had the tax grant program in place, 1603, because people weren't reliable on tax equity. That caused a huge boom in buildouts and allowed a lot less complex deal structures to propagate. Now, unfortunately, that's not in place anymore. We can hope, but probably not until after the next election, would be the guess at least. So where are we left, and what are some folks like myself trying to do? Our team is working to try to unlock the standard private capital markets to benefit from this boom in local cost-saving, energy, control providing generation. A lot of folks say, I can arbitrage directly to the gas market with CHP. I can, avoid any of that, any type of fuel standpoint with solar and such. But the problem is that the markets have yet to evolve where we've gotten out of a boutique deal flow. And this is why standardization is so important. Does anyone here know what the leading security has been over the last 100 years, the top performing security investment? Top performing that you could have invested in. If you could go back in time 100 years ago as an asset class, any guesses? It's energy sector related. I'll give you that hint. Anybody? Utility bonds. Traditionally the best performing and absolute safest investment you could have ever made. I mean, it's the little old lady in tennis shoes to turn the phrase. Why are utility bonds such a good deal? Well, it's usually a pretty good bet that if someone's going to spend the money on building a building like this or a house or so on, that they're probably going to continue to power it if they're going to use it. And so the expectant regularity of revenues coming back from the traditional utility operation, that people are going to continue to want warm showers and cold beers and, have use of the modern age, drove the security and the safety into those types of investments. And that's why investors have flocked to it. Energy savings can rest on the exact same foundations. My team at the firm, led by a colleague of mine, Baird Brown, just finished the largest ever energy efficiency revenue bond offering that's been made. It was a $70 million revenue bond offering. We were bond counsel and program counsel to the Delaware Sustainable Energy Utility. This was the first time ever that major creditors, major credit rating agencies, and our underwriter, which was Citi, took into account the energy savings delta in the financing. And the reason we were able to do that was through a strong suite of standardized energy performance contracts that were linked in a structure to the installment payments out of the agency to be able to do this. What's the bottom line? The bottom line is that several state agencies throughout Delaware pay $0 up front, get energy savings, retrofits, central plant retrofits, everything from the most simple of caulking to windows to advanced new steam plants and so on. They pay zero up front. And over the 25-year of course, as the bonds amortize and the program winds down, the program will save the Delaware Treasury and all these agencies net over $20 million in profit above savings. So the whole thing is driven and paid for by the savings. And the reason we were able to do that was through a deal structure legally that allowed for a chain of assurance to make sure that those monies came through, resting on the exact same theory that made utility bonds such a good investment. The exact reason why, when these bonds hit the private markets, they were taking up in a heartbeat. There was no reserve, the underwriter didn't make anything like that, taken up in a heartbeat from the private bond markets. And it's because that's that exact same theory. That's really this tectonic shift that we're seeing right now, is that we're seeing demand-side resources developing if we can find the ways to unlock pooled financing around these, which can be one of the most efficient ways to do it. We can start to see mass deployments not supported by specialty grant programs or loan programs or so on. We still need all those programs. The industry is still getting on its feet. But we need to be able to work on tapping established private markets, and there's no reason we shouldn't. And this is why the savings that are occurring at the community scale, this kind of tectonic shift, is so important, because it is going to change the way that the deal flow is going to work for quite some time. And it also, to a certain degree, gets away from many of the friction that's created at a lot of levels, even within the environmental community, between more conservation-minded folks and more technologically-minded folks. It can be a difficult world when you want to do the right thing, it's hard to get a project through and cited. And this is why efforts like the one Jim is talking about is so important, giving regulators roadmaps to be able to go through this and do this. Why? Because if you don't have that, it's a crapshoot. And I'll give you an example. Wind developers, up until they were the PTC expiration killed the wind development pipe, one of the more common things that had arisen in terms of studies in feasibility was looking at the prevalence of second home sites within the viewshed or around the footprint. The more second homes you had, the better chance there was going to be a well-funded opposition, because you had more people there who were there not because that's where they lived and worked and so on, because they were there because they invested in that property because it represented an aesthetic to them, a certain aspect of the natural world usually that they wanted to see happen. And when I say see happen, they wanted to go there without seeing any aspect of any industry, regardless whether it's clean, dirty, fossil, or so on or whatnot. So there are challenges that are being faced right now. The advantage of community scale is that we already have these universities. We already have these hospitals. We already have all these big state agencies and buildings. We have places that has a huge opportunity in terms of developing resources that are clean. It'd be the hope that this could be the new boom area for the renewable field, because otherwise it's very difficult to add significant renewables beyond the compliance ramps that the RPSs are demanding right now, because load's flat, gas prices are keeping market prices of power low. That doesn't just mean renewables are hurt. That also means that the overall cost that society is paying for power has a little more wiggle room to bear higher costs to get the types of technologies that are the energy future for this country in place. And with that, I'll turn it over to Michelle, who can talk to you a little bit about some of the more impressive, larger scale CSP projects.
Is there anybody I can see? Okay, great. So my name is Michelle Boyd. I am the Government Relations Manager at Abengoa Solar. I'm going to talk today. Let's see if we can. Nope, that's not what I wanted to do. How do I do this? Oops. How do I go forward? Ah, thank you. Okay. All right. Today, because I'm last but not least, I have to cut my talk very, very, very short. So I'm going to just spend a couple seconds on who Abengoa is.
Pick the whole 15.
Okay. I thought we had 10 minutes left. So, okay. And I want to talk a bit about what concentrating solar power is, and then I'm going to talk about the three major challenges to doing these kind of projects, which is siting, transmission, financing, and then finally, hopefully, end this panel on a little bit of a positive outlook, hopefully. So Abengoa is a very large international company. We do energy and environment. The vast majority, about three-quarters of what we do, is energy, including solar, biofuels, cogeneration, and transmission. The other 24% is focused on more engineering, industrial waste recycling, and desalinization. As I said, we're an international company. We have more than 800 people working worldwide. Right now, we have 543 megawatts of solar in operation and more than a gigawatt under construction. Here's a map of where we are active in the world, and it will coincide coincidentally with where the best solar resources are for concentrating solar power. But as you can see, we have headquarters in the United States in Colorado, and we also have headquarters in Spain, which is where this company started. CSP technology, so there are two types of solar energy, or two flavors, as some people say, diffuse and direct beam. The photovoltaic technology, which is what most people are aware of, the panels on the roofs, that can use both components, can use both diffuse and direct beam. But concentrating solar power really can only use the direct beam, which basically means the heat of the sun. So it's using the heat of the sun to generate electricity. And the best resources in the United States for this kind of technology is in the southwestern U.S. And we have some of the best in the world. Here's a map showing those resources. As you can see, the red parts are the best of the best, and that they are in California, Arizona, New Mexico, and Nevada. There are different kinds of CSP technologies, and I'm not going to have time to go through all of them, so I just want to focus on two that are the most common. One is the parabolic trough, and the other is the power tower. The parabolic trough, the idea is you have a parabolic mirror, and when the sun hits that mirror, if you remember from your physics class, all the rays are reflected to the center focal point. And at that point, there's a tube, a receiver tube, that collects the heat of the sun. There's a liquid in there called a heat transferred fluid that gets very, very, very hot, up to 700 degrees Fahrenheit. And that the liquid goes through these tubes all through this huge facility. I'll show you a big picture of one. And when it gets to the center of the facility, this heated liquid is used to boil water, and that steam is used to turn a turbine, which is used to make electricity. You will note that it's very similar to the concept of a coal plant or a natural gas plant or a nuclear plant. Just something needs to boil water to turn the turbine to make electricity. But in this case, we're using the energy of the sun. They've 30 years of experience with CSP technology. They're one of the largest plants in the world, or the largest, maybe, in California. And right now, as I mentioned before, we have Abengoa has 531 megawatts in operation and another 950 megawatts under construction of parabolic trough. And here's a diagram. It's a little too complicated to go into great detail, but you can see the movement of the fluid is the red line as it moves through and becomes steam that moves the turbine that creates the electricity. The power tower is a very similar concept, but you have, instead of the troughs, you have what are called heliostats, which, again, are mirrors, not PV panels, that reflect the sun onto a tower. And that is used to concentrate the sunlight, and that concentrated heat is then used to boil water to make steam to turn the turbine. So, again, a very similar concept. There have been power towers in operation for 5 years, so it's a relatively new technology, and Abengoa has 31 megawatts in operation. And I'm going to skip that slide for time. We have currently in the United States, Abengoa has two projects in under construction. One in Arizona called Solana, and one in California called Mojave on the Mojave Desert. The picture at the top here is on your left-hand side is a artist rendering of what the project will look like when it's done. It looks very small, but it's actually going to be about 3 square miles, so it's very large. And I'm not good at spatial numbers, so 3 square miles is about, I calculated, about 1,400 football fields big. So we're talking about a huge, very large facility. Both of these projects are 280 megawatts gross output each. 280 megawatts is about the size of about half of a coal plant or a third of a large nuclear plant. The picture at the bottom is an artist rendering of what the Mojave project is going to look like when it is completed. The Solana project is slated to be completed next year and the Mojave project in 2014. Both of these projects are parabolic troughs, so we talked a lot about what that means. And both are on private land that we purchased, so neither of them are on public land, so we haven't dealt with the BLM issues, but we will talk about that a little bit later. And together, these two projects will generate enough electricity to power about 124,000 homes. So there are a couple of really unique pieces to CSP technology that are different than PV or wind. CSP plants can actually be paired with what's called thermal energy storage, which means that you actually can store the heat and then create electricity later when the sun isn't shining. So when you hear that renewables can't create electricity when the sun isn't shining, you now know that is not true, that there is a technology. Geothermal is another one, but there are technologies that can create electricity when the sun is not shining. That means that we can create electricity in the morning when people are getting up and turning on their dishwashers, or when they come home late in the afternoon and turn on their air conditioning. We can be there for the utility to provide electricity. We also can dispatch electricity within 10 minutes, which means that we are baseload power. It also is, very interestingly enough, CSP is not really a competitor for PV. What the NREL, the National Renewable Energy Lab, is finding in its models is that the more CSP technology that's put on the grid, the more stable the grid is, and you can actually add more intermittent PV and wind technology. And I'm going to show you a picture of what that looks like in a minute. But here's how we store the heat. In these enormous tanks that are full of molten salt. And so the picture at the top left is the construction going right now in Solana in Arizona. And that's the picture on the right at the top is a picture from the air. So you can see these tanks are really big. Two of these tanks are a football field. So these are not small tanks. And then at the bottom is a picture of what it will look like, an artist's photo of what it will look like. So essentially what we're doing is holding the heat in a big thermos bottle. If you compare, this is what I promised to show you, comparison of PV and CSP. When you look at a sunny day, they're pretty much the same, kind of, you know, creating electricity about the same. But on a cloudy day, you get some real drops in electricity production with PV. And CSP can smooth out that curve. And then if you have storage on top of that, CSP really can allow for a lot more PV to be brought onto the grid. Another benefit of CSP, which is true with all renewables, is that we have environmental benefits, including decrease of emissions, carbon dioxide, nitrogen oxide, sulfur dioxide. It's really important to remember that as we're looking at these very large projects that do use land and have other challenges. Another benefit of CSP technology is that these projects are very high technology and they require manufacturing. And so the supply chain for Solana, which means the companies where we're buying products, are from the United States. We're really focused on buying products from the United States and creating manufacturing jobs here. As you can see, the projects that are happening are in Arizona and California, but the benefits are across the entire country. So there's manufacturing, and for example, the mirrors are being built at a facility, at a manufacturing plant in Arizona, for example, is just one example. But all of the bits and bobs, and there are a lot, everything from trailers to fences, to the heat transfer fluid, to everything. It's a lot of stuff. Solana will be over 70% made in America, and Mojave will be over 90% made in America. So these are real projects that are not just benefiting the Southeast. Across the United States, there are 507 megawatts operating. The largest is the Sykes plant in California, which has been operating since 1985. It was different. There's nine of them, and they were built between 1985 and 1991. My understanding is that they're actually more efficient now than they were when they were built because the technology has been improving and changes have been made. There are also about 1,300 megawatts of CSP plants being built right now in the United States and expected to come on between 2012 and 2014. So there's a few challenges to building these projects, including siting. The most important first step in actually creating a project like this is to have a site. What does a good site mean? It means good solar, which is in the southwest or western United States, on flat land near transmission. I'm going to talk more about that in a minute. With a road nearby, it can't be really out in the middle of the desert because you've got to ship all these products, all these bits and bobs in. And I say bits and bobs, but they are large pieces of bits and bobs. And you need some water. And so, and not only that, you need to make sure that there's no environmental, cultural showstoppers. So that's a huge challenge in the Southwest. One of the biggest challenges is protecting the desert tortoise, which is an endangered species. And then, of course, there's the cultural issues of Native American communities and artifacts in the desert. So these projects, as I mentioned, are very large. You need about a mile squared for 100 megawatts. So the size of Solana, as I mentioned, was about 3 miles big. The BLM is in the process of identifying solar energy zones, which Abengoa Solar strongly supports. The concept of zones, which is basically the concept of putting several of these projects together in one area and doing a large industrial park rather than having these scattered all over the desert. And we strongly support that. The BLM process is underway, and they're looking at identifying these zones. There are some improvements that need to be made to this process. First of all, the zones are too small, so you can only put a project or two at these sites, which kind of defeats the purpose of not having the projects scattered all over the desert. And there aren't enough of them to really go around for the kind of projects that are being proposed. We also do not support, for example, putting limitations such as height, because these towers are actually quite tall. There are, of course, height restrictions if it's in military areas, and that all, of course, has to be followed. But arbitrary height limitations or technology limitations really shouldn't be part of the decision of whether or not these projects can be built in certain areas. There's so many other factors that really should go into making these decisions. The exclusion areas, which is the places you can't build, should not include factors such as slope. Right now, yes, it's true with trough technology, you need flat land, but technologies change, and putting in those kind of limitations right now don't make sense. Basically, the industry will self-select on slope and insulation, insulation being the amount of sun and the quality of the sun at the site. And then finally, most important, and I'm going to talk about this more in a minute, is that the proposed zones are actually not located near transmission. And the site could be as perfect site as you possibly can imagine, but if without transmission, you can't get the electricity out, so you're not going to build there. And until these zones are really viable, developers are going to continue to look at private sites, which can be difficult to find 3 square miles that you can purchase and build one of these projects near transmission. But we're going to continue to look for federal land and private sites where we can build while the zones are being developed. Again, you've seen this map, but I wanted to show you this is the ideal situation where, wow, there's so much land where these projects can be built. But in fact, once you filter out all the things that the environmentally sensitive lands, the urban areas, the slope issues, the fact that these have to be at least a square kilometer, if not a square mile big, then you end up with a map that looks something more like this. And this is not a great map because it makes it look like there's absolutely nothing out there, but it does show you that there is a lot of good solar sites that can't be used simply because people live there, for example. But there's still enough and there's still ample land for plenty of these projects to be built and make a serious contribution to the U.S. electricity sector. Transmission is a very, very, very complicated issue, and I'm only going to talk about it at the most shallow level, which is, as I said earlier, we need it. All the CSP plants right now that are under development have a transmission plan and will be able to get their electricity out of the site. But as we look forward, there's going to be a growing challenge to get these projects sited with transmission, because the transmission in the Southwest is very congested. And building these projects takes years to plan, permit, and build. And it's not simply a matter of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission coming in and telling people and saying that's where it's going to be. It's a very grassroots, bottom-up type of process where localities, states, and NGOs, and industry, and everyone has a say. And so it's unclear how long it's going to take, and that's really, really probably, I think, the most difficult challenge that these projects face. And then finally, financing is another challenge. There we go. Right now, there are two federal financing incentives for CSP technologies. First is the Federal Loan Guarantee Program, and second is the Solar Investment Tax Credit, which is, goes through 2016. The Solar Investment Tax Credit gives a company a tax credit for building these when they build these projects. However, many of the companies that are building actually don't pay taxes yet, so it's not very useful. And so the concept is you go to the tax equity market and they cash it for you and basically give you the cash. Well, that market is very, very thin, and there aren't that many players, and even fewer after the 2008 crash. So the ITC is kind of difficult to use. There was a program that was discussed a little bit earlier by Christopher about the 1603 Treasury Grant Program that actually allowed the government to give that tax credit in cash to the project developer, but that expired at the end of last year. There is an effort to reinstate that, but it's unclear whether it will be reinstated. So in the meantime, the ITC is an important piece of the puzzle, but it is challenging to use it. And then finally, the Loan Guarantee Program has been under a very public attack by some members of Congress, but there's still support for the program, and there are a question of whether it will be revised or somehow changed so that it can continue. But at this point, its future is quite uncertain. And then finally, outlook. Well, we have some wild cards that have been discussed at various points today. First and foremost is natural gas. It is cheap, and it's unclear how long it will stay that way. But basically, most technologies are having trouble competing against cheap natural gas. But the environmental issues are unclear how much that's going to impact the cost, and natural gas tends to be very volatile. So although the cost is low now, it's going to rise at some point when and how and what the environmental impacts and issues are going to mean on price is unclear at this point. And then also wind and PV, there are utility concerns about having this much variable electricity on the grid and what that means for their stability and reliability, and so CSP could play a role in that. And then financing, we've talked about. Really important for these projects isn't that they're really, really risky projects. They have, in order to go forward and receive financing, they need to have a power purchase agreement, which means the utility promises to buy the electricity from these facilities. So when we start building, we already know who's going to buy the electricity. But the problem is that they need long-term, low-interest financing, so 25 to 30-year financing. Most banks aren't willing to look out that far, and they're certainly not willing to give loans of more than $1 billion. So what we need access to that kind of long-term, low-interest debt. So what is the outlook for CSP? It really depends on some factors that are beyond the control of developers, such as federal budgets and policies. But the CSP is an important piece of the renewable puzzle, and the outlook is positive. CSP adds to resource diversity with storage. It provides dispatchability, again, meaning that we can, at a drop of a hat, provide electricity to a utility when they need it. It provides stability to the grid, which we've talked about. The costs, we are focused as a company on bringing the cost down. Everyone knows that the subsidies aren't going to be around forever, and we need to figure out how to bring these costs down and make them make these projects competitive. But it is still quite a new technology, even though it has been around for a while. It hasn't had the supply chain advantages that, for example, natural gas has or other types of more traditional electricity energy sources. And then finally, CSP creates jobs and stimulates the economy, which has been, as I showed you, the supply chain. So I'm going to stop there, and I've talked really, really fast to try to get done in less than my time allotted. But thank you very much.
Thank you very much to all of you. In the interest of time, I think we'll take just a couple questions. So if anybody has any questions, you could just step up to the microphones that we have on either side, and we'll just take a few.
My name is Anand. I'm from Georgetown, the electrical guy. I just want to know if anyone can speak
it's a real pickle, isn't it? I mean, it's you take an issue that, really divides the community, because there's a lot of folks who, from the development side, the installation side, like to see this pace of installations that we've seen happening with the price of PV panels dropping, especially the crystalline from China. This, though, is one of a hornet's nest of trade issues between us and China. It's also worth noting that we have a number of, trade cases involving biofuels and so on between us and Europe and such. It'll be interesting to see how it comes out. Without question, the drop of PV prices helped to drive along the solar development pipe. At the same time, that wasn't enough. You needed the incentive structures in place, the solar tiers and RPSs, the solar renewable energy certificate markets, and importantly, the ability to have easy routes to monetization on the tax side, and so on. There's certainly tax equity investors out there, but they are more sophisticated investors, many of which want to see strategic plays on the underlying assets and a fit in their portfolio. So the trade case is a good thing to cite. It's hard to see where exactly it'll come out, but from a development perspective, it definitely has been good seeing the prices drop from a panel perspective, that's for sure.
Most of the work I do is U.S. or domestic focus, so I hesitate to make comparisons with other countries. I know Germany invested a substantial amount in promoting wind as a way to get off of brown coal, but I haven't studied the policies that were behind that. I think the diversification issue here to me depends primarily on the ability to sustain to kind of a market acceptance level, sustain wind and solar in particular, so that they're ubiquitous enough that they're not sort of hard to finance or opposed on a case-by-case basis around the country. But they've achieved enough kind of recognition with the state legislatures and local governments and members of Congress so that it's just another variety of energy, just like the many other varieties of energy that we've had. They're still a little exotic, and I think that's posed some problems for the industry on the public policy as well as on the finance side.
I was wondering if Mr. McElfish and Ms. Boyd could discuss the cost differentials between wind and solar energy.
So the price of CSP is actually considered confidential, so I can't tell you, unfortunately. But I can tell you that it is significantly more expensive, for example, than natural gas. But it's also not as variable, so you're not looking at, having if the entire country moves to building natural gas, when prices go up, everyone is surprised, even though that happens regularly. So I think diversification of supply is really, really important because you're not going to get that kind of price shock with CSP. And also, as I mentioned, we're focused on bringing the cost down. We understand we need to be able to compete against more traditional types of energy. So that is it's a huge goal that we have. Right now, I think that the focus should be on diversification and focusing on building up our renewable sector.
If you if you go to any of the major public utility commission websites or search for installed capacity cost curves, you can find out. Generally, the way it looks right now is that at the bottom for these are new additional generation units, greenfield units. You have a gas combined cycle almost neck and neck with new wind. Right now, although that is with, depending on who you talk to, that's with various tax supports, other supports for wind, you begin to go up from there and you get into actually several other types of renewable categories of generation before you start to hit the really big ticket new units, which are the new nuclear units, advanced clean coal with carbon capture and sequestration, and so on. So, the greenfield game in the United States for utility scale in the next several years is definitely a gas and a wind game, with large CHP projects and so on coming online where they're going. But again, the big challenge is we don't have a lot of load growth in the country. There's not this big upswell of demand. And so as you have more and more efficiency programs, demand side programs coming in that to the main grid just look like efficiency. A hospital puts in a big solar power array and a big central plant CHP system. As far as the grid is concerned, all of a sudden a big load center just shed 80% of its load and doesn't need it for a while. So as far as the grid sees it, you have these big energy efficiency penetrations that's not really driving the development pipe the way we would. There's also, here in New England, there's tons of gas generation, throughout the Midwest and so on, that is just what's called out-of-market heat rate. These are units that cannot produce power even with low gas prices at a way that they would be, very competitive with where the market's setting the heat rate. They're improving, but they're not there. So, that's part of the challenges where we're facing. There certainly is, if you level the playing field, more grid parity. And as mentioned to Jim, everything is cost competitive. It just depends on the term of the financing and how patient your capital.